Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 118, The Psychological Impact of Materialism, November 10th, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
And what we find is that the more important that people rate those materialistic or extrinsic goals to their whole value system, actually the less happy they are and the lower their quality of life. We've done dozens of studies, and other people have done studies at this point, showing that the more people buy into these messages of consumer society, the less they're satisfied with their lives, the less they report being happy, the less they report being self-actualized and feeling vital, the more depressed, anxious, etc., that they also are.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Tim Kasser. After receiving his Ph.D. in psychology from the University of Rochester, Tim Kasser accepted a position at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois, where he is currently an associate professor of psychology. He's authored over 55 scientific articles and book chapters on materialism, values, goals, and quality of life, among other topics. Tim's first book, The High Price of Materialism, was published by MIT Press in 2002. His second book, co-edited with my previous guest, Alan D. Kanner, Psychology and Consumer Culture, was released by the American Psychological Association in 2004. Since 2005, Tim has served as an associate editor at the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, Personality Processes and Individual Differences. He also works with activist groups that try to protect children from commercialization and that encourage a more inwardly rich lifestyle than what is offered by consumerism. Tim lives with his wife, two sons, and assorted animals in the western Illinois countryside. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Tim Kasser, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you, and I was referred to you by Dr. Alan Kanner, who I believe you know, and who I interviewed, a few shows back about the commercialization of childhood, and he suggested that you would be a great person to do a follow-up interview with, because I guess some of his ideas are founded on research that you've done on the psychological impact of materialism. So let me have you tell us about your work and specifically about your research.
Sure. Well, since the early 1990s, my colleagues and I have been interested in trying to understand what people's values and goals are, what it is that they're striving for in life, and how it is that that relates to the quality of their life. So we've developed a variety of different ways of trying to understand what's important to people in life and what their goals are, and we have different questionnaires or methods we give them where we essentially, for example, we might present them with a variety of different goals, like to have a real close relationship with my family, or a goal like to really understand my spiritual life, or a goal like to have a lot of fun. And we ask people to rate how important those goals are, and we're able to get a sense then of how a person is trying to construct his or her life. Now, some of the goals that we ask people to rate are goals that are really relevant to the messages that people receive from consumer society. So the three main goals that we consider and that the research shows to be materialistic goals are goals for making a lot of money, having a really nice image, which is usually mediated through some kind of possession, you know, your clothes or whatever, and then status or popularity, which again oftentimes is expressed through financial or consumatory sorts of ways. And so we've been looking at that sort of package or cluster of goals, which we sometimes call materialistic goals or sometimes called extrinsic goals, and trying to understand how pursuing those kinds of goals influences people's lives. And what we find is that the more important that people rate those materialistic or extrinsic goals to their whole value system, actually the less happy they are and the lower their quality of life. We've done dozens of studies, and other people have done studies at this point, showing that the more people buy into these messages of consumer society, the less they're satisfied with their lives, the less they report being happy, the less they report being self-actualized and feeling vital, the more depressed, anxious, etc., that they also are. So I think one of the things that's really important is this finding that even though consumer society tells us and capitalism tells us that the way to the good life is by making a lot of money and having all of these possessions and caring about these things, unfortunately, that's a false promise. And it turns out that the more you take those things on, the worse your quality of life.
Okay, yes, you write, in fact, that the more people value materialistic aspirations and goals, the less they are happy with their personal lives and the more they act in ways that are socially and ecologically damaging. And you've already hinted at this, but maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, what the personal costs are, what the social costs are, and then what the ecological costs are.
You bet. You know, when we first started the research, we were really focused primarily on the personal costs. So in our early studies, we were looking at things like life satisfaction or self-esteem or depression or anxiety, because those are the kinds of outcomes that really are just about the sole individual's happiness or well-being. And as I mentioned, and we found over and over that the more people take on these materialistic messages, the lower their well-being and the higher their ill-being. And lots of people have shown that by now, and I think it's a pretty well-documented finding. And I would mention that it's been shown in kids as young as 10 and adults as old as 80. We found it in men and women. We found it in rich people and poor people. We found it in countries all over the world. So this idea that materialism is associated with low personal well-being is I would say, fairly well-documented. And my book, The High Price of Materialism, is really about that finding primarily and why people are unhappy when they're materialistic. But over the last 5-6 years or so, other people and my colleagues and I have tried to start to look at things outside of people's own personal well-being that might be influenced by materialism. You know, because, you know, if somebody says, well, it's okay, I'll be a little bit unhappy so I can be rich, you know, well, that's their decision. But the problem is that what we found and what others have found is that the more materialistic people are, they actually end up treating other people in ways that negatively influence other people's well-being, and they negatively also influence the health of the earth. So I'll tell you about a couple of studies relevant to that if you'd like.
Sure.
You know, so in some of the studies with regard to social well-being, what we found is that the more people take on those materialistic messages, the less they're empathic, so the less they try to understand how other people see the world, the more likely they are to be what's called Machiavellian. So if you remember Machiavelli, who wrote the book The Prince, and basically it's a handbook of how to obtain and keep power by manipulating other people. Well, what some research has shown is that materialistic people are more manipulative or more Machiavellian in the way that they treat other people, which isn't going to be very good for other people's well-being. Other research has shown that if you put people into game kinds of settings where they can earn points by either cooperating or competing with other people, the more materialistic people are more likely to choose the competitive route, which unfortunately has negative impacts on other people. We've found that materialistic people have worse, more conflictual interpersonal relationships and also shorter interpersonal relationships. So there's this sort of, again, cluster of ways that materialistic people act, which not only make themselves unhappy, but which seem to make other people unhappy. And then with regard to ecological well-being, this is something that I became interested in really just a few years ago, largely out of my collaboration with Kirk Brown. And what we've started to do is to take a look at the ecological behavior of materialistic people. So I don't know if you're familiar with the idea of the ecological footprint.
Yes, I think we're hearing a lot these days about the carbon footprint, for example.
Sure, yeah, and it's a similar idea, and the idea of the ecological footprint is how much of the Earth's limited resources does it take in order to live your life? And, you know, that's based mostly on your food choices, on your transportation choices, and on your housing choices. And what we found in our research is that people who are more materialistic are likely to be making the kinds of choices which lead them to have high ecological footprints, high carbon footprints. They're also likely to do things, or really they're less likely to do things which are good for the environment. So in one of the studies, we gave people a long list of different, you know, positive things they could do for the environment, like use plastic bags again, or recycle, or walk, and when they, you know, could also drive a car, which kinds of things do you do? And we found both with children and with adults that the more materialistic people are, the less likely they are to engage in positive environmental behaviors, and the more likely they are to engage in behaviors which damage the Earth. So, you know, it's sort of a triple whammy here for materialism in my mind. It undermines people's own happiness. It seems to work against a sort of a civil, cohesive society, and it also is damaging the ability of the Earth to sustain itself over time, and thus the quality of life of our grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and other species.
Well, some people listening to this might have the reaction that you're somehow un-American, and I wonder if you've run into that, because you do write about that there are value and goal conflicts resulting from what you call American corporate capitalism.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm an American, obviously. I've lived here all my life, and I think that there's much that is great about our country. But I also think that there's much that is problematic about our country. And one of the things I think is clearly problematic about our country is that we are obsessed with profit. We're obsessed with consumption. We're obsessed with making money, with economic growth. And, you know, I think that this can be seen in lots of different ways. So, for example, after September 11th, when President Bush was asked, what can the average American do to help the country, he told them to go shopping, okay?
Yeah.
Now, we always are looking for economic solutions to different kinds of problems. And we don't sign the Kyoto Accord, et cetera. I have indeed been accused of being un-American, or I've been warned that what I'm saying could sound un-American, but I guess I view it as very American. It's about free speech. It's about using science in order to help us to figure out what the best paths are for our country to take in order to maintain safety, in order to maintain the nation, in order to maximize people's quality of life. That's what I'm interested in. And I think that the problem is that we have a nation which has been taken over largely by big corporations, and they're running the show, and the show that they're running has to do with their own profit. And profit pushes out other values. That's the problem. So the extent you start to focus on these kinds of materialistic values, other things become less important to you, like people's quality of life, like children in poverty, like the environment, etc. And those are the things that are important. Those are the things that the Founding Fathers wanted us to be able to give to each other as a nation, not profit at all costs.
Well said. And you do acknowledge that there are some strong points to capitalism,
sure,
even while you're criticizing it. So before we go more into the critique, let me give you a chance to acknowledge what you see as the strong points.
Well, I think one of the things that capitalism does well is to create wealth. Okay, I think that there's no doubt that if you let people pursue their self-interest and you let people to pursue the chance to, you know, set up businesses around the things that they're especially interested in, and to run their own show and not be overly dominated by, you know, governmental planning and such, that can unleash people's creativity, it can unleash certain kinds of motivation, and, you know, there's no doubt that the kind of capitalism we have thus far has really created immense wealth, you know, and for some people at least, and
yeah,
has created a lot of different consumer products, some of which are quite nice, has possibly created some really good technology for healthcare and transportation, although I'll note that the Russians beat us into space without a capitalistic viewpoint, et cetera. But I guess my point is that it can create wealth, it can create a lot of great opportunities for certain people to do certain things. So, you know, and the problem is our particular form of capitalism, you know, there's different kinds of capitalism, and our particular form of capitalism has been really good at creating wealth, but it's come at some costs as well.
I think in some ways, maybe we're like the fish swimming in water that supposedly is unaware of the water because the fish is just immersed in it. And we're so immersed in the capitalist system, I think, that we equate it with freedom, with the freedom that we enjoy.
Yes.
And you even use an acronym in some of your papers that I read, TINA, which stands for There Is No Alternative.
Right.
And it seems like we do have trouble in envisioning an alternative to the capitalist way of life, that the general perception is, well, geez, you're asking me to give up all my stuff.
That's right.
How will I get along without all my stuff?
Well, quite well, probably, you know, because most of the stuff that we have at this point isn't stuff we really need in order to survive and get by. And the research actually shows that over the last 50 years, as people in America have gotten more and more stuff, they haven't gotten any happier. All the research suggests that happiness has remained stagnant over the last 50 years, despite the fact that we have twice as much stuff now as we did back in the 1950s. So probably we'll get along just fine, actually. But the system doesn't want us to know that, okay, because the system is predicated on the idea that you need to keep people motivated, you need to buy money, you need to keep them in a state of desire for more money and more goods, because that's what makes the wheels of the economy turn. And so it is set up in a way in order to keep people so that they remain motivated to be good members of the society. You know, the analogy that I often draw is with religion. You know, in order for a religion to survive, it needs to convince people that if they don't follow that religion, something bad's going to happen to them. They're going to go to hell, or they're going to be reincarnated at some lower level, or God's going to punish them one way or another. And it needs to give people motivation, positive motivation, to stay in the system, you know, so you'll get to heaven or good things will happen. It needs to do all kinds of things in order to incorporate people and make people believe that this is the best system possible. And that's why we have a lot of wars around religion, right? Because everybody thinks their system is the best one, but you can't have two bests. But people take on these ideas, and they believe them, and they believe that this is the only solution. And the same is true of capitalism. You know, I teach a class called Alternatives to Consumerism that has probably some of the most consumer-aware students on my campus in it. I teach at Knox College in Illinois. But last year, when I asked them to try to tell me what capitalism was, they just all stared at me blankly. They didn't understand really what capitalism is, because it's this silent thing that just infuses so much of our lives, but that we rarely are able to point to and say, ah, there's the system at work. And that's because the system's always at work.
Yeah. So what's the alternative? Do you have any kind of vision of either a modified capitalism or some alternative? I mean, you know, as you point out, for most of us, it's pretty hard to envision what the alternative might be.
Well, see, that is part of the problem, because I think that most people think, okay, well, if you're not living this lifestyle, then there are three possible alternatives. The first is that you're like Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber.
Yeah.
You know, you're some crazy guy living in a shack, and nobody wants that. A second alternative is the Amish. They think, oh, well, there's the Amish, you know, but people don't really understand what the Amish are living like, although I'll note that the Amish research studies show the Amish are some of the happiest people in the United States, least likely to have depression, alcoholism, etc. But most people are saying, no, I can't do that either. And then they think, oh, well, it's North Korea or the former, you know, USSR, and then people say, oh, well, that failed, you know, or is failing, so that's not going to work either. And that's what locks us into this Tina mindset, okay, this, that there is no alternative. But there's a woman in Europe whose name I forget right now, but she has the alternative to Tina she calls Tata, which is there are thousands of alternatives.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and, you know, and I think to me the issue is that unites those alternatives is that other values besides profit, besides consumption, need to be injected into the economic and the social situation, into the economic and social system. So one of the things that we've found over and over again in our research is that the more people care about materialistic values, the less likely they are to care about three other values that we call intrinsic values. So those three intrinsic values are for self-acceptance and personal growth, so kind of knowing who you are, understanding yourself, liking yourself. The second one is affiliation, which is having close relationships with other people like your family and your friends and such like that. And then the third is what we call community feeling, which is the desire to make the broader world a better place. So not just you and your family, but, you know, people on the other end of the world or polar bears or, you know, homeless people or whatever. And what we've been able to show empirically in lots of nations and what other people have documented is that there's this conflict between the materialistic values and those three intrinsic values, that the more people tend to focus on the materialistic values, the less they focus on those intrinsic values. And in fact, there's some research nowadays that has shown that the more a nation has an economic system which is like the United States, the less its people care about those values. Okay, so Shalom Schwartz recently published a paper about that. So the more we get infused with these heavy materialistic values, the less we care about the intrinsic values. The intrinsic values, though, are the ones that our research shows tend to make people happier, tend to provide social cohesion, and tend to lead to sustainability in terms of the ecology. So from my viewpoint, and that's kind of all the background to answer your question as to what the alternatives are, the alternative is to develop a set of economic principles and to develop a set of lifestyles which are infused with intrinsic values and which give people the opportunity to express those intrinsic values in their day-to-day life. It's really hard to do that under capitalism because of lots of different kinds of pressures. So I can give you some examples of how I see that we could do that.
Great.
Okay?
Yeah.
So I'm going to sort of start at the most personal and then work my way up to the biggest, most social.
Okay.
So at the most personal level, have you ever heard of the concept of voluntary simplicity?
I have, and I imagine most of my listeners will have heard of it.
Okay, so it comes from a great book by a guy named Dwayne Elgin called Voluntary Simplicity. And the idea of voluntary simplicity is that people bag out of the high consumer work spend lifestyle and instead focus on things like their own personal growth or religion or their family and volunteering. So we just did a study, Kirk Brown and I did a study, where we compared 200 mainstream Americans with 200 self-identified voluntary simplifiers. And what we found was that the voluntary simplifiers, compared to the mainstream Americans, were happier, they were living in a more ecologically sustainable way, even though their salaries were only about two-thirds what the mainstream Americans were. So here, and the reason that they were happier, and the reason that they had ecologically sustainable behavior, according to our statistical analyses, was that they were more focused, the voluntary simplifiers were more focused on the intrinsic values and less focused on the materialistic values. So here's a lifestyle, here's a set of people who've been able to say, you know, I'm not going to participate in that society so much. That's not where my mind's at. And by doing so, they're actually happier, and they're living in a more sustainable way because they're able to enact those intrinsic values, because they're able to have more opportunity to be involved with their family or pursue their own personal growth or volunteer and such like that. So I think that's one excellent model, which is totally against, you know, the whole capitalistic, consumeristic mindset, even though consumerism has tried to co-opt it with, you know, magazines like Real Simple and such like that. I mean, that's real simple by buying stuff. I mean, simplicity is about really living in a more simple way. But these people are happy. So I think that simplicity is one excellent solution. I think another excellent solution is something I've been writing about lately called time affluence. You know, in our nation over the last 30 or 40 years, work hours have gone up about 160 hours a year. So what that means is that the average American is working about 4 weeks a year more than they did 30 years ago. Compared to Europeans, we work about 9 weeks per year more than the Europeans, okay? Like 14 weeks per year more than like the Danes and the Norwegians. You know, 14 weeks they have off more than we do, okay?
Yeah.
Now, that time affluence is something that's really important for people's well-being. So we have a paper coming out in the Journal of Business Ethics showing that even after you control for how wealthy somebody is, how much time they have, their work hours, is a predictor of how happy they are. So people with more time, they're able to spend more time doing those kinds of activities that are related to the intrinsic values. They have more time for their family. They have more time to volunteer. They have more time to pursue their hobbies, and therefore they're happier. Furthermore, there's some studies showing that the longer, more work hours people have, the worse their ecological behavior. So, again, I think time affluence and the chance to give people more time is something which is really important. Now, that's something you can make a choice about, right? Like you can say to your boss, well, you know, I don't want to raise this year. I'd rather have an extra 2 days of vacation, or I'd rather, you know, take every, or 2 weeks of vacation or whatever. I'd rather take every other Friday off. But at the same time, we really need some national policies around that. So, for example, we're one of only 5 nations in the world that doesn't have paid leave for a woman when she gives birth to a child. Okay? Most nations in the world give a woman at least 6 weeks paid leave. Cuba is actually one of the best in the world in terms of giving people time for their families. We don't give them anything. Okay, we're one of the few nations in the world that doesn't have a mandatory minimum vacation law. Most nations in the world, including China, for example, mandate a certain number of weeks of vacation per year paid. There is no such law for that in the United States. And the result is, especially poor people who are stringing together a couple jobs don't get any vacation. Okay.
I think in a way, I think we're sort of proud of that, like because we get this message that we need to be very productive. And so we all have this productivity drive.
And that goes back to that capitalistic ideology that we've incorporated and internalized, okay? That goes back to us being the fish in the capitalistic water, okay? That we've bought into this message that's what's most important and that's what the highest sign of a good life is going to be about. But
yes,
that's not what the research tends to show. You know, but I totally agree with you. I think it's ideology, but it's not just ideology. It's also institutional pressure. There are plenty of people out there so there was a study conducted by the Center for a New American Dream that suggested that about half of Americans would be willing to take a cut in pay in order to work fewer hours. But the problem is they live in a society where it's very difficult to actually do that, because of the variety of different pressures that occur and no national level support for that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you go ahead. It sounds like you're on a roll.
You think so.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if your listeners think so. you know, a third kind of approach that we could talk about is more at a national indicator level. So, for example, right now, our main way of determining whether or not the nation is doing well is the gross national product per capita, right?
Yes.
You know, so if GNP is growing, then things are good. If GNP is not growing, things are bad. But GNP is all it is an indicator of how much economic activity is going on. So it includes things like like companies making money off of pollution and companies making money off of cleaning up pollution. It includes paying prison guards. Like, building new prisons is good for the economy, okay? Pollution at some level is good for the economy. If I get in a car accident and kill somebody, at some level that's good for the economy because somebody had to go out and buy a coffin, okay, and have hospitalization charges. Driving our cars and buying a lot of gasoline is good for GNP per capita, okay, because all it is about economic exchange. Now, to the extent that we think that that is the be-all and end-all of what our nation should be striving for, back to Bill Clinton, it's the economy, stupid, right? You know, so long as we think that what's most important is economic growth, and so long as we think that economic growth is best measured by GNP per capita, what we're going to do is keep creating situations in which case we do all kinds of things that might bring wealth, but that work against those intrinsic goals, that work against happiness, against sustainability, et cetera. So there's a variety of different possibilities out there for alternative economic indicators. So some psychologists have called for a national well-being indicator. There's a group called Redefining Progress, which has publicized something called the Genuine Progress Indicator, which takes out a lot of the bad from GNP and adds in some other things. The Kingdom of Bhutan, which is a little country in the Himalayas, it doesn't use GNP. It has something called gross national happiness, which it is trying to maximize.
Wow.
There's a group in the UK called the New Economics Foundation, which has a couple of different indicators, including one called the Happy Planet Index, that the Tories actually almost adopted. Okay, so you know, if we could get policymakers to at national, local, state levels to think about these kinds of indicators, we could recognize that not all economic growth is good for the nation, and we could start to say, well, how can we maximize genuine progress? How can we maximize gross national happiness? And we would start to see that allowing corporations not to pay any taxes and to pursue profit at all costs wouldn't be the way to do that,
yeah,
even though it might be the way to maximize GNP.
Well, let's talk a little bit about psychology as a profession and how it interfaces with all of this. First of all, what sort of psychologist were you trained to be? A social psychologist or what?
Well, nobody's actually sure, to be honest. As an undergraduate, I did cognitive and health psychology. I was admitted to a clinical psychology program at the University of Rochester, but all of my funding during my years there was from social and motivational and developmental psychologists. So I really don't consider myself to be any particular kind of psychologist. And at this point, I'm really, as you can probably tell, I'm pretty informed by sociology and economics as well. So I guess I view myself as somebody who's interested in the human situation, and so I need to know about all of those things in order to make sense of them.
Yes, and when you first started to do this work, you found that there was hardly any psychological literature on the topic of capitalism, for example.
Well, and that's still the case. So in a paper that we just published this year, we found only a handful of studies, including one of my own, that mentioned capitalism in the abstract of the paper. So capitalism, just like it's the water for the fish for all the rest of us, when the rest of us are the fish, that's definitely the case for psychologists. We tend not to have looked as a profession at that more distal economic situation, which determines a lot of our behavior.
And partly that's because it's the water we swim in, but is another part of it because it's also a sacred cow?
I think a big part of it is that it's a sacred cow, absolutely. You know, psychologists want to appear very objective and apolitical, and so they and a lot of them have internalized that same capitalist ideology that we were talking about before. And so to turn and talk about those kinds of issues, I think, is something most people don't consider doing. I also think that, you know, the fact is psychology has actually been one of the reasons that all this has been so successful. You know, there are thousands and thousands of psychologists with PhDs out there helping make the commercials that are fed into us. There are thousands and thousands of PhD psychologists out there figuring out ways to maximize worker productivity. You know, so psychology has been somewhat complicit in this economic system.
I'm smarting under that because I'm involved in market research and have been for some years. And, I agree with what you're saying.
Okay.
And I don't want to go, it's something.
Well,
go ahead.
Not all market research is bad. You know, I mean, you know, there's certain things that need to get marketed to people in certain ways. And I think, you know, there's the question of what's being marketed.
Yes.
And there's the question of how it's being marketed.
Yes.
And I'm not trying to say that anybody who's ever done any market research is therefore, doing something that's ultimately very problematic. But let's face it, the vast majority of what is marketed to people is not marketed in the most ethical fashion, nor is it stuff that people really need usually.
Yeah, we're on the same page in that regard. Well, you know, I could really talk to you quite a bit more, but I think we're kind of beginning to run out of time here. So I wonder if there are any last words you'd like to offer.
One of the things that I guess I would like to just say in closing is that when you talk to a lot of people about materialism, most people will say, yeah, you know, our society has become too materialistic. Yeah, corporations have too much power. Yeah, I really don't like the way that corporations market to my children, etc. But a lot of people feel kind of hopeless about it. They feel hopeless that there can be a change.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is the whole Tina mentality, that they don't think that there are alternatives. And part of it is because corporations do indeed have so much power, and so much of this seems like it's out of our hands. I guess what I would like to say is that it really is the case that a better world is possible here, and that there's a phrase that Martin Luther King used called a revolution of values. And he said this in the late 1960s, that what our nation needs is a revolution of values. We need to move from a thing-oriented society to a people-oriented society. And we haven't done that. I think we've gone more and more towards the materialistic values and more towards the thing-oriented society. But that doesn't mean we can't. You know, we actually do live in a democracy. We actually, you know, we could put Coca-Cola out of business tomorrow if everybody just decided to stop drinking Coca-Cola. We could put media companies out of business tomorrow if everybody just turned off their television. We actually do have an immense amount of freedom. And most people, I think, know at some intuitive level that what's really important are these intrinsic values. What really is important is their family. What really is important is pursuing their own personal growth. What really is important is helping the world be a better place. And that's what my studies show over and over again. And I think what we can do as psychologists and as social scientists is to say, okay, how can we actually move the world in that direction, given that we have the freedom to do that? We're not in Myanmar. We're not in Russia 40 years ago. We have the freedom to make these kinds of changes if we push on it and if we think about it and if we design the right kinds of social situations and if we as psychologists are willing to get involved in policy measures and to talk about these kinds of things and step out of the ivory tower and discuss the real world here, because this is about the real world. So I actually believe that as depressing as all of this is, there actually is a good deal of hope potentially that we can make these kinds of changes and really create something that is a mite bit better than what we have now.
Well, Dr. Tim Kasser, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, it's been a pleasure to be with you. I've enjoyed speaking with you.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Tim Kasser. It's wonderful to know that there are psychologists like him out there who are addressing such fundamental issues that relate to our happiness and our long-term survival. Personally, I'm on the same page with the issues he's championing, and it's good to know that there's a growing body of research that supports the importance of the sorts of intrinsic motivations that he's described. When I was much younger, in graduate school, as a matter of fact, I had lots of back-to-the-land sorts of fantasies. Back to the land. I was never on the land, but still, we had these back-to-the-land fantasies. My life, as it turned out, took a different direction, and so I never made it to that rural and seemingly simpler lifestyle. I do try to keep my materialism in check. My wife and I are both driving older cars. We live in a non-ostentatious house in a non-ostentatious neighborhood. Of course, it's pretty hard to get too materialistic on a professor's salary, especially when we had four kids in the house. As I've gotten older, it's become more and more apparent the degree to which we don't own things as much as they own us. All the stuff that we own seems to require upkeep or protection or maintenance of some sort, and so it ends up eating up lots of our precious time. And other than my addiction to electronic gadgets, there's not much that I want. As a matter of fact, right now, I can't think of anything that I want right now. Even in terms of electronics, I've got all I want. So I feel very blessed in that regard. And even having said that, however, there still seems to be a steady flow of material stuff that comes into my life. And right now, we're coming into the holiday season. And personally, I could do just fine without all the extravagant gift-giving, but I haven't been able to persuade my family of that position. So I'll end up trying to meet their expectations, and I'm also going to end up receiving a bunch of stuff from them. It's a strange thing to complain about, but stuff seems to accumulate faster than I can get rid of it. I try to be ruthless about giving it away and or selling my old stuff. I've got stuff right now on eBay, electronic stuff that I'm trying to get rid of. I've seen friends whose houses or apartments I can hardly move around in because they've accumulated so much stuff over the years. Tim spoke about free time and vacation time and so on as a form of wealth. And in my own life, I see technology, which, as you know, I'm quite a fan of, but it also has a dark side. As much as I embrace it, and it has soaked up an awful lot of time. In the early days of my being a professor, it seemed like I had a lot of time to spend on recreation and getting together with certain students to play tennis or go on hikes. And then as computers came into our lives, as they came into my life, we were able to get so much more done. And consequently, people expected us to get much more done. And these days, if you walk around a university or corporate offices anywhere, and as you look through the open doors, you'll see people staring at computer screens. And in the past, I think you would have seen more people engaged in face-to-face conversation. So these tools that were meant to save us time end up being enormous time sponges and also raise the expectations about what we're supposed to be able to accomplish in our available time, so that we end up having less and less available time because, oh, well, you can be so efficient. Here, you can take on this extra task. And that's not necessarily imposed from the outside. Often it is imposed by a boss or somebody in authority, but we internalize this and start expecting of ourselves to be productive. And certainly I'm speaking for myself, and I'm assuming that maybe this applies to other people too. But hey, don't get me started.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. Dr. Davis here to remind you it's all in your mind. Exploring our spirit and our psyche, we are learning to unwind. And Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. We're all in your mind. We're all in your mind.
I think I over-apologized about the sound quality on last week's in-person interview with my colleague, Dr. Charles Merrill. I heard from one or two of you that it wasn't so bad, and as I listened to the final production, it seemed within the acceptable range to me. However, I have gone ahead and ordered two headset mics that I'm very excited about. They haven't arrived yet, but I think it's going to greatly improve the quality of the in-person interviews. This is important to me because it seems to me that the sound quality of an in-person interview should be at least as good, if not better, than that of a Skype interview. So I hope I'm not being too materialistic and going out and spending more money for microphones. But hey, it's really all about trying to provide you with the best possible listening experience that I can. Now, if you haven't been listening to Shrink Radio, Wrap Radio from the beginning, let me remind you that you'll find the archives of the early shows on our site at shrinkwrapradio.com. We have to keep the feed at a manageable size, so with each new show, we drop an earlier show off the feed. So, for example, if you go to iTunes today, you'll probably only find shows from number 43 on. However, you can find the first 42 on our website. Now, 50% of you reported in our poll that you'd be interested in a Shrink Wrap Radio t-shirt if it were available. And there's an online company called Cafe Press, and I think they can be found at cafepress.com. And they provide such things at a reasonable cost. And I went to their website, but I couldn't quite figure out how to set up the templates for printing and how to get the logo sized right, make everything fit in. I could really use a volunteer to help me with this. So if anybody out there has worked with Cafe Press or you have the graphic skills needed to resize logos, etc., please contact me and we'll move this forward and get some t-shirts going on the site. Now, I've put a new poll up on the site at shrinkwrapradio.com asking whether or not you'd be interested in an occasional live call-in show. Would you like to be able to call in and to make comments and or ask questions? I've lined up an account with Blog Talk Radio, which hosts that kind of show. And to call in, you'd have to call their New York phone number. But if you got on Skype or some other VoIP service, voice over internet protocol, you could call the New York number for pennies per minute, wherever you're located in the world. And I'm not sure how I'd set this up. I think I would ask one of my psychologist friends to be a co-host to give it a bit more live energy. And we might discuss the most recent interview from the regular podcast, or we might just throw out a random topic for discussion. I don't think I want it to be an advice show, though. With people calling in and asking about psychological problems that they have, because I think that might have some legal and ethical barbs in it. So I'd be interested in any ideas that you might have about a desirable format. In terms of time, I'm thinking I'd probably choose a morning time in the Pacific time zone where I'm located on a Saturday or Sunday morning. This would allow folks all over the U.S. and also in Europe to call in. It would be early evening in Europe, late afternoon or late morning or early afternoon on the East Coast. So I think that might be the best time to choose. So please write and let me know what you think of this idea. Take the poll on the website and also drop me emails and let me know what you think of this idea. And by the way, I should hasten to mention that this would be in addition to the regular Shrink Wrap Radio podcast, not instead of it. By the way, I've put up a very brief Shrink Wrap Radio promo on YouTube. Please go to it by going to youtube.com and doing a search on Shrink Wrap Radio as three separate words. If you all go and take a look, it'll help drive up its popularity and maybe more people will see it. Please feel free to refer friends to it or to link to it on your blog, your website, or your podcast. Or if you know how to create an even better one for Shrink Wrap Radio, run that by me. I've got some books I'd like to give away as prizes. These are books that I've reviewed for this podcast or for my other one at Wise Counsel Podcast. So send me some cool audio transition for the show and I'll send you a book. Or post a positive review on iTunes and I'll send you a book. Now, of course, I only want you to post a positive review if you genuinely feel positive. I don't want you to say anything you don't mean. If you do post such a review to iTunes, email me a copy of it and also your mailing address, and I'll send you one of these books. Unless so many of you do it that I run out of books, but past experience doesn't suggest that that's going to happen. This show is sponsored by Podshow, and you can subscribe to it if you haven't already at podshow.com. And we're also sponsored by GoDaddy, where you can get the domain name downwithmaterialism.com for a 10% discount by using the code SHRINK3 at checkout.
It's Jeff and Carl Jung saying, you're on the couch with Dr. Dave. Your thoughts on the show, Carl?
I think there will be a reaction. A great change of our psychological attitude is imminent. That is certain.
Right on then. Take it away, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Jeff and Carl, for that creatively inspired transition. Now, on to the mailbag. First, we hear from Paul in Canada, who writes, I'm a PhD philosophy student at the University of Ottawa and a regular listener who enjoys listening to your show. I'm wondering if you'd consider doing a show on philosophy and psychology. I believe this crosses with your own area of humanistic and transpersonal psychology, which I'm also very interested in, and that crosses with my current thesis on memory, narrative, identity, and the creation of our life stories. I would be interested in helping you coordinate such a show. Hope to hear from you soon and keep up the great work. Sincerely, Paul. And then Paul and I, we had a little bit of follow-up correspondence. And Paul, as far as I'm concerned, the ball is in your court. I would love to do this, but I want you to line up the other people that you wanted to have be in on the discussion, because I think you suggested one or two others that you thought would be great. And so if you can line up some people who are willing to do it, I've got the technology where we can all get in on a Skype conference call, and I think that'd be a lot of fun. So let's pursue that. Next, we hear from Susan, who is referring to the show that I did at the podcast, A New Media Exposition. And she writes, I really enjoyed the PNME interviews, especially the representation of women. Doug Kay's vision for podcasting is a joy to hear again. And that's Susan. And I agree. I very much liked Doug's very positive, egalitarian vision for podcasting, to do it as a free service and to ultimately record all meetings everywhere and make them available as podcasts. And I'm glad, Susan, that you and I think other people enjoyed the interviews from the podcast expo. Next, I hear from regular listener and contributor Anna the Manna, who writes, just finished listening to number 116, your interview with Nook and Tomas. I am still digesting this interview. I had a hard time connecting to their ideas. No problem with your questions. I just lost them on their exposés. If I can't wrap my mind around it, I'll probably skip the review on my blog. He's been reviewing in his blog just about every episode, and I really appreciate that. He goes on to say, on the email section, I immediately rushed to see the pictures at the blog of Alex Razvan. And on the question of what language we meet there, my guess is Romanian. And you're right, Anna, we had another listener whose email I read in the last show confirmed that. Anna goes on to say, Romanian, which is just as good a guess as your guess is, that is Portuguese. It certainly looks like a Romance language. I know enough Portuguese to be rather sure it's not that. So what is left is Romanian or Romanish, which is a minority language in Switzerland that has only some, looks like you say, 300,000 native speakers. And he refers me to a Wikipedia page there, so I'm glad we've got Alex Razvan nailed down there. And Alex, I hope you're still listening to all this wonderful attention that you're getting. And next I hear from another longtime listener, also in Israel, just as Anna is. This is Cody in Israel, who writes, thanks for the bonus track. That's that bonus track that I resent to everyone who had submitted a survey. She says, thanks for the bonus track. I already have it, but I listened to it once again. Now that I'm writing down my dreams and trying to understand them, I enjoyed that track even more than the first time I listened to it. I continue to listen to your wonderful shows. I especially like the number 115, Existential Humanistic Psychotherapy and Education, with Myrtle Heary, PhD. I agree with her that globalization isn't such a bad word. I know that she speaks about the importance of global understanding of each other based on compassion, courage, hope, tolerance, and resilience. But even in the economy, globalization isn't such a bad word. Just look at the spread of clean technology all over the world that will allow people to live a healthier life. Cody, thanks as always for your observations and your continued listenership. Next, we hear from Karen, who writes, just wanted to let you know that I loved listening to show number 66. Well, you're way back there, Karen. To show number 66 about what therapy really works. And that, Karen, that's one of my very favorite shows of all time, I think. She says, like all of your shows, it was informative and enlightening. I laughed when you mentioned primal therapy at the end of the show. Primal therapy is the reason I first came to California and ended up doing it off and on for 2 years before I realized it wasn't really doing anything for me except for wearing out my lungs, screaming and crying. I wish I had been able to listen to a show like yours before I started doing all my therapy. It would have been a lot more beneficial, and I probably would have saved a lot of money. Thanks so much for another fantastic show. You are invaluable. Warm regards, Karen. Karen, thank you very much for that feedback. Sorry I didn't get it out years ago and save you all that money on primal therapy. I have to say I've seen a lot of therapies like primal and others come and go, and it's made me just a little bit jaded, I'm afraid. We hear from another longtime listener. I think she's responding to the fact, again, that I sent out that link to the survey bonus track on dreams, and it's from Jennifer Linton, the artist in Canada who I interviewed in one of the early podcasts. And she says, thanks, Dave. I've been trying to keep up with your podcast, but it's been rather challenging for me lately. My second son, Nigel, was born in May of this year. So the two kids have kept me busy and out of the studio. I always listen to podcasts on my iPod in the studio. And as I'm only sporadically working these days, I'm behind on the shows. Hopefully this will change in the not-too-distant future. All the best, Jennifer Linton. Jennifer, I fully understand, and I hope you make it back into the studio, not only for the benefit of listening to Shrink Wrap Radio, but also so you can keep up your wonderful artwork. Oh, she also, I see, she mentioned a couple of her favorite shows. She said, still catching up. No, actually, this comes from another listener. I'm sorry. This comes from Michael, who's another longtime listener in Illinois. And Michael says, still catching up. He's fallen behind as well. And he says, two of the best of many excellent shows, number 89, The Secret Spiritual World of Children, one of my favorites as well, Michael, and number 79, Understanding and Improving Memory. And Michael, I'm taking the pills that he recommended. They might be helping my memory, I'm not sure. He says, in the latter of these, you and Dr. Crook discussed false memories. I would not be surprised if, at least in some cases, false memories and mental illnesses are caused by the confusion, either spontaneous or therapist-induced, of the real world with either one's dream world or one's past lives. Well, that's an interesting speculation. He goes on to say, memories of past lives may play a role in children's spiritual worlds. For example, your anecdote about one of your sons as a small child telling you that he wished you were his age may be suggestive of a relationship the two of you had in a past life. Well, you know, that I certainly had to entertain that when that happened. There was such a depth and spiritual resonance between us in that moment that that really was one of the live hypotheses for me. Michael goes on to write, a therapist who deals in past life therapy or a researcher who has regressed subjects to past lives would make an interesting guest. And that's a good suggestion. I could do that. I know some people would, you know, I'm not sure if I believe in past lives, but I would like to reserve the privilege to have guests on that I don't necessarily agree with. And I'm going to say more about that in a moment in response to an email that somebody else sent. Michael wraps up saying, I haven't listened to the other podcasts on dreams you did this past May. Well, I hope you will. Thanks for writing, Michael. The next one reads, and this is actually the one that I was very interested in responding to. This one comes from, it would be Leicestershire in American, but it's probably Leicestershire, I would guess, maybe, in the UK. It's from Bruce, and he writes, hi, Dr. Dave. I subscribe to your podcast. Good. I like people to subscribe. Both Shrink Wrap and Wise Counsel from iTunes. I listen to the shows with interest, but I must say a couple of things. Firstly, I know that you have a lot of shows to fill, but a lot of your guests, it seems to me, have quirky, new agey type books to peddle rather than mainstream psychology texts. Some of these quirky guests are really enjoyable, like the guy who did Analyzing George Bush, because he was at least referring to mainstream psychological concepts. Some of your other guests, like the flaky couple who were talking about the ego but then invented their own definition of it, are just pink medicine men. I don't know what pink means in that context. Are just pink medicine men, and I think don't really have a place ideally on your shows. So as far as the content of your shows are concerned, I would quite like to see a series of programs with either yourself or a mainstream psychologist guest educating us about the main points of psychodynamic counseling or concepts talked about by Freud or Jung or other mainstream clinical psychologists. I'm going to pause in reading the email here to make some comments, Bruce. I understand what you're saying, and sometimes I kind of hesitate about interviews such as the one that I did on that one, and I'm blocking on the title and their names right now, but I know the show that you're referring to, it was about two shows ago, and it had to do with getting rid of the ego as part of the spiritual quest and so on. And, you know, my approach to these interviews is, first of all, to be a generous and kindly interviewer as much as possible. it really doesn't fit well in my personality to be all that challenging. I've actually heard from one or two listeners who thought that I was too challenging and inserted too many of my own ideas into the interview. So one of the things I've learned is I can't please everybody, but I kind of know what my nature is, and my own nature is to try to be as accepting as I can. And I might seem, in the process, I might seem a lot more credible and a lot more gullible than I really am. I don't agree with everything that my guests say, but I also don't want to be all that challenging. And I know that there's a real spectrum out there in the world, and ideally among my listenership, some of you out there are going to be able to embrace things that are too far out for me, are too weird, are too new age, too whatever. But I want to give these people a hearing. I'm happy to give them a platform. I'm happy to give them some exposure. And I trust my audience to have their own critical evaluation skills and to be able to dismiss what they feel that they need to dismiss. So I don't necessarily endorse everything that that you'll hear here by way of interview. I think you can generally tell in my commentary when I'm really enthusiastic about something and when I'm, you know, kind of more so-so. And so I think your response certainly makes me a bit more hesitant, but I think I'd still like to go ahead and invite some of the guests on who have books and so on that they are trying to promote that you might in fact find flaky. Now, for example, the guy who wrote the book on analyzing George Bush, he is a very well-qualified psychoanalyst, and you went on to say that you'd like to hear more about psychodynamic theories and so on. So this guy, even though he wrote a book that might be somewhat controversial, in terms of psychoanalysis, this is a fully certified, respected, as far as I know, well-trained Harvard graduate person. And some people might say, well, that's flaky. Some people would dismiss psychoanalysis altogether. And so, you know, there's no way it's going to appeal to everybody. Okay, I probably said way too much about that. If people have opinions about what I've just said, I'd love to hear what your opinions are. Meanwhile, getting back to Bruce's letter, he says, I have a brother who has qualified as a British professional counselor, and he would like to recommend your shows to colleagues as a form of keeping in touch with existing ideas and new ones. But listening to some of the guests makes me think that they really haven't got anything to teach except their own indulgence. Well, again, I'm hoping that your brother and his colleagues will have the judgment to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff, you know, depending upon their own standards and so on. I can tell you that there are a number of professionals who do listen, and I hope that they will continue to do so. The second point is not really a comment on your show as much as a bit of dismay at what gets through in the psychology industry. It seems to me that a lot of your properly qualified guests are all pushing their own sect of psychology. I've heard with interest your little bit of irritation that people are applauding positive psychology as a new thing, whereas you would see it as just a recovered version of humanistic psychology that you were involved with early on in the 60s. That's true. I do have some feelings about that. At the same time, positive psychology has introduced a new strain of research and a renewed emphasis on an empirical approach to those ideas. So there is a unique contribution that positive psychology is making. I just wish that the founder had tipped his hat more to the contribution of humanistic psychology. Bruce goes on to write, I was interested in a letter you read out recently from a woman who now designs greeting cards who said that she was only just coming out of the disgust she felt at having spent thousands of dollars on a psych postgrad program only to find that there are few jobs in it. Yes, she was writing about art therapy. Listening to a lot of your guests, it seems to me that a lot of money they make is not so much out of treating patients, but out of developing so-called post-grad studies to sell to people to train in the new branch they've just developed. And Bruce, I do agree with you that there is a fair amount of hucksterism in the field, and people are out there continually putting old wine in new bottles and selling it. And so you're right to alert us all to that. He says, I'm not really interested in the idea of selling out thousands to learn about something that won't be of any benefit. I'm not really interested in the idea of shelling out thousands to learn about something that won't be of any benefit to me and in which the concepts are woolly. I'm much more interested in learning about proper clinical psychology and psychiatry. I think a lot of other guests will be too, apart from, of course, these human resource managers with huge training budgets to spend. Okay, well, sorry for an epistle, but I just wanted to share my views. Thank you, however, for taking the time and trouble to actually produce a show for the public education and entertainment. And he signs it Bruce, Leicestershire, England. And Bruce, thank you so much for taking time to send those concerns. I do want to hear people's concerns as well as all the wonderful praise. And they're legitimate concerns. And I may continue in my own way here anyway, but I really appreciate hearing it. And of course, I'm glad that you're subscribed to the Wise Counsel podcast, because those people, I think, will measure up to your standards more than some of the people here on Shrink Wrap Radio, where I give myself a lot more latitude. So I think that better wrap it up for today. And you can send your emails, as usual, to shrink@shrinkwrapradio. And remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod. And you're encouraged to leave voice messages on MyChingo, and you'll find a link to that on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. And you can call in and leave a voicemail on our phone. I get no calls. I haven't had any voice stuff in a while. That number is 206-337-0622. So I want to thank Dr. Tim Kasser, for a wonderful interview on the downsides of materialism and how it negatively impacts our goals and values. And I want to tell you that our next podcast will be with Dr. Tony Madrid. It will be a fascinating interview on the use of hypnosis and EMDR in repairing broken maternal infant bonds. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.